Pieces come and go, and I'm forever grateful. Come and tell me long and slow exactly what I wait for. Better times, yeah, better times. Somehow I don't believe it. I built a house up long ago just to up and leave it.
It's our annual Pollinator Week episode of On the Wing podcast. That's right, June 17th through June 23rd is the nation's annual celebration of pollinators and pollinators' critical importance to our natural world. By now, you undoubtedly know the connection between pollinators and pheasant and quail habitat. Their pollinator habitat is the exact same thing we refer to as brood habitat, a diverse mix of grasses, legumes, and forbs or flowering plants. And they're identical, and they're both critical to the habitat needs of pollinators, butterflies, honeybees, ringneck pheasants, and all six species of quail. So from the backyard 40 to your backyard, with projects big and small, creating native habitat benefits pollinators, the birds, the bees, and all sorts of other wildlife. Native habitat that supports pollinators absolutely supports pheasants and quail, because the chicks of pheasants and quail primarily eat, or their diet consists primarily of soft-bodied insects. And those insects gravitate towards pollinating plants. And it's the diversity of plant species found in pollinator plantings that provides important habitat for nesting and brood rearing habitat that pheasants and quail need. And we've added a fun little wrinkle this year. We're going to list the top 10 wildflowers as voted on by a sampling of Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever biologists. That's right, a top 10 list of our favorite wildflowers. And I'll get into how we got to a top 10 list in a moment. Our featured guests are two members of our biology team. They're going to break down our top 10 list, but let's meet them first. Sierra Garner, you may know her as Sierra Rhodes. She's the pollinator coordinator for our organization in Tennessee. We'll get into the name change momentarily. And Heather Francis, our farm bill biologist in Nebraska. She's been with us. She's been on a number of rooster road trips, too. And we'll touch on that in a moment as well. And Sierra, I think we'll kick off with a congratulations. I alluded to your name change, Sierra Rhodes. Many folks know is your maiden name, and that changed about a week ago, didn't it?
Yeah, May 25th, I tied the knot with my new husband, and we were able to have a beautiful, beautiful ceremony. It was supposed to be nasty weather, and it turned out to be absolutely perfect. We had lots of friends and family come out and join us, but we also were able to include all of our native pollinator, native wildflower habitat mindset into the wedding. So I was really excited about it to see it, and I can't wait to see our pictures.
So like, we got to start there. You included your native wildflowers into your wedding. Tell listeners how you did that.
Yeah, so first off, my number one goal was to have my bouquet to be all 100% native wildflowers to my area. Normally, I will say I am not a proponent of going out and picking wildflowers because I want them to be available for the pollinators and the quail, which need them far more than I do. But
it was just one bouquet. It's okay.
Yeah, one special occasion. I was like, okay, I got to do it. But so I had this big, beautiful bouquet that was all native wildflowers. So I can't wait to see the pictures from it. It's going to be beautiful. But then I also, all of my centerpieces at my tables were all native warm season grasses that I gathered last fall when they were in seed, and I like hairsprayed the crap out of them to keep the seed on them. But they were perfection. And then Also, one of the favors that we had for our wedding favors was I created these custom seed mixes and these little packets that I was able to hand out to all of my guests. And so I made sure the mix, I worked with our Quail Forever, Pheasants Forever, Quail Forever seed store, and we created a mix that was native to most of the eastern United States where all of our guests were coming from, or most of them. And yeah, that was what our wedding favor was, and got to design the packet and everything. I was excited.
There might be a new marketing opportunity there.
Yeah, my dad was like, "Can we sell these?" And I was like, "I mean, I guess, but it's a lot of work, Dad."
Oh, that's very fun. Well, congratulations. Heather's got a wedding story of her own that we'll get into in a moment, but tell folks a little bit about where you grew up, Sierra, and what you do for the organization and how it connects to pollinator habitat.
Yeah, so I actually grew up in West Tennessee in a little town called Selmer, and have kind of moved around for different jobs and schooling around West Tennessee, Mississippi, Missouri, things like that. But I was recently a farm bill biologist in Arkansas for the last 6 or so years, and really got my footing there and learned a lot more about pollinator plantings and stuff. That was kind of my forte in that role. From there, I again was about to get married, and so a job opened up for the pollinator coordinator. It's actually with Working Lands for Wildlife, so I cover like the eastern half of the United States, everything in the Bob White framework, and I'm just based out of West Tennessee now, so I get to work from home and the local NRCS office. So
So for folks that maybe don't know Working Lands for Wildlife or the Bob White framework, you're funded through the Natural Resources Conservation Service, which is part of the USDA, to create habitat specifically benefiting Bob White quail. And the pollinator component in there is an absolute perfect overlay, isn't it?
correct. That's absolutely right.
Great. Now, Heather, you have a wildflower pollinator connection, wedding story of your own. Tell us about your wedding story.
That's correct. My youngest son got married the same weekend that Sierra got married, and our flower connection is all of their flowers were made out of Sola wood. And when we get the flowers, we purchase the flowers, they're all cream colored, and then we can dye them any color that we want. And so she had a great array of beautiful flowers that we dyed to match their wedding theme. The other part of the connection with our wedding is my son was a range judger in high school. So they had to know warm season, cool season plants, as well as shrubs and forbs. And we had Indian grass and big blue stem in their boutonnieres as fillers, as well as using some turkey feathers. And Georgia had beautiful pheasant feathers in her bouquet, as well as some really nice black and white striped turkey feathers. And then the centerpieces for their wedding were clear liquor bottles with 3 to 4 pheasant tail feathers in them with one flower in them. So it was really fun to work with the kids and work with our families together to get those flowers dyed and have this pheasant outdoor connection and flower connection with their wedding.
For our listeners, I dare you, listeners, to try to find two people that would include their passion for both pollinators, habitat, and upland birds together in their own wedding, in their wedding of their child. That is why Sierra and Heather are just absolutely perfect representatives for today's very fun podcast. Thank you for both sharing that your personal stories. I think I'll throw in mine. I had or my wife and I, we had pheasant on the menu. That was our wedding meal for our wedding. So we had beautiful flowers. They weren't as cool as both of you with the natives, but we had a pheasant connection with our wedding too. All right, Heather, tell us a little bit more about your backstory. Where you're from, how you got connected to the organization, and a bit about your career, what you do every day for Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever.
I'd be glad to share that story with you today. I have been working with Pheasants Forever as an employee since 2013. I started as a farm field biologist here in southwest Nebraska. We are approximately 35 miles from Kansas and 35 miles from Colorado. I've lived in this part of Nebraska since 1987. I'm a Nebraska native. I've lived in Nebraska my whole life, and my father was an avid outdoorsman and always told me that I could do whatever I set my mind to. And he's the one that got me started hunting when I was young. I kind of fell back out of hunting for a long time and then I'm definitely a reactivated hunter. And then I've worked with our Pheasants Forever chapter. So we're the Southwestern Nebraska chapter in Southwest Nebraska. And I really started working with the chapter a lot with our Learn to Hunt Youth Mentor event. And we've had events since 2001. We've had over 300 kids go through our local youth program. And that's a really fun event that we get to do. And then our chapter is also active in doing pollinator plantings with our FFA chapters. And that's a little bit of the pollinator connection as well. And most people that know me, I have a camera in my hand everywhere I go. So one of the Rooster Road trips I got to go with Bob on, that's what I was doing. I was shooting with my camera instead of my gun. But I've always taken pictures of the beautiful plants that are blooming in the pastures. And I never really knew the connection until I started working for Pheasants Forever and found out most of them are natives. And just love being out on the landscape, learning about new forbs, learning the importance of pollinators and the importance of these blooming plants to all of our upland game birds. So it's really come full circle for me. I love that part.
When I envisioned you in my mind's eye, there is always a camera around your neck.
Yes.
Well, thank you both for joining me today for this conversation. And, you know, I'd be remiss if I didn't also thank Kim Cole, our Habitat Education Program Manager, who has set us on the path to success for this year's Pollinator Week. Kim has recently left to take a new job, but she's planned out what is proving to be a tremendous Pollinator Week promotion for our organization. And I want to thank a few of the sponsors that have been working with Kim and our organization to bring content during Pollinator Week forward. Those partners include Corteva AgriScience, Bayer, U.S. Crop Science, Syngenta USA, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the Monarch Joint Venture, and Bass Pro Shops and Cabela's Outdoor Fund. So thank you to those corporations for helping us bring Pollinator Week to the Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever audience. Then also, this week, as we've done the past, five, 6 years, we have a special Pollinator Week promotion. For a $35 or a $75 donation, you can pick. You'll get a native plant kit that includes 6 different wildflower plugs. I'll talk to you about those a little bit more in detail in a moment. You'll get an 8x10 pollinator habitat sign, a brand new exclusive Habitat Creator sticker, and the signature element, a membership to Pheasants Forever or Quail Forever, your choice. You can go to pheasantsforever.org/pollinatorweek or quailforever.org/pollinatorweek. I mentioned that I bring up those 6 pollinator plugs, those wildflower plugs. Based on where you sign up, your zip code, we've got 5. That's right, 5 different pollinator plug mixes based on your geography. We've got an eastern and a southern mix, 3 different plants, includes prairie phlox, butterfly milkweed, and rattlesnake master. Hold on to that name, it's going to come up again. We got the central and north mix, which includes Ohio spiderwort, butterfly milkweed again in gray goldenrod. We've got a Dakotas and a Minnesota combination that includes common yarrow, world milkweed, and blue giant hyssop. And then we've got two different Rocky mixes, west of the Rockies northern states and west of the Rockies southern states. So western broke up into two. They both include aspen fleabane, and one includes showy milkweed, the other one includes butterfly milkweed, and then one includes Missouri goldenrod and the other western pearly everlasting. As you can see, there's a lot of geographic ecotypes based on where you are and what plants are going to be best for you. And those mixes or those three species will come to you if you join through the pollinator special at pheasantsforever.org/pollinatorweek or quailforever.org/pollinatorweek. They do include a variety of bloomers, early, middle, and late bloomer in each. So we've thought about pretty much everything when Kim put that those different plants together. Speaking of plants, we're going to get to our top 10 wildflowers as voted on by a sampling of Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever biologists. So how did we do that? How would biologists choose their favorites? So we had three different criteria that we surveyed, a sampling of the Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever biologist team. Kim sent out a survey to evaluate pollinating plants, forbs, flowering wildflowers, for three different ways. Number one was structure. Does this plant create cover and habitat, particularly from avian predators? Does it create structure for pheasants and quail? That's the first criteria. The second criteria was sort of a combo platter. It was, does this plant provide a food resource? And the reason I say it's a combo platter is some plants provide food in the form of seeds that pheasants and quail eat. And then some plants are like magnetism or magnets for insects, which created protein type of food for pheasant and quail chicks. So food resources are part A and B of number two. And then number three criteria was the wild card. And the wild card is beauty. Some, you know, anybody that's looked at a prairie or a savanna or a glade, one of our grasslands, and by the way, it's National Grassland Week as well as National Pollinator Week, knows that wildflowers are just absolutely stunningly gorgeous. So that's our wild card. If their plants rose up into the top 10 by a factor of their beauty. All right, I belabored it long enough. Structure, food, and the wild card of beauty. Let's go to our top 10 list. All right, number 10, Sierra's gonna get us rolling with number 10 on the wildflower list. Go ahead, Sierra, take it away. What's number 10?
Number 10 is showy tick trefoil. The Latin name is Desmodium candidens, for those of you wanting to Google it, because there might be several common names. This plant is a favorite of mine. I've learned several cool little tidbits about it over the years. But one of the reasons that we picked it for one of the top 10s is it does provide a good seed resource for our bobwhite quail, wild turkey, as well as some small rodents and other game birds. Like, I'm sure if it's in the pheasant range, pheasant are probably eating it as well. I myself, just FYI for listeners, am only in the quail range, so I can't speak for pheasants. But on the pollinator side, since it is pollinator week, it is a larval host to silver spotted skipper, eastern tail blue, and hoary edge, which means it's part of their life cycle, whether that means, you know, they're probably laying their eggs on it, the caterpillars might eat primarily on it, things like that. This plant has like a really light purple bloom. There, even though it's called showy tick tree foil, to me it's not that showy. It's not something that I look out in a field and it's what my eyes instantly gravitate towards. But among the tick tree foil group, the Desmodiums, it does have a very showy flower, which is probably how it got its name. But there are these little like light purple blooms, and they do have a lot of flowers on the, you know, inflorescence up top. They produce their seeds, and I'm sure a lot of hunters out there, as well as any outdoor enthusiasts, are going to be very familiar with this plant, because these are the plants that produce those little bitty triangle Velcro seeds that get all over your clothes. Huh. That's the Desmodiums. So they are a great, as you can tell, I mean, they're a great food resource because they produce tons of seeds. I'm sure they probably have fantastic nutrient quality as well. I did learn a neat little trick that we ourselves can eat these while they're green. Hmm. It's kind of like edamame. I mean, you obviously have to eat a ton of them to get any sort of resource, but they taste good.
But don't eat them in the fall, right?
Yeah, they're going to be kind of crunchy then.
I had no idea that's where those little ride-alongs came from the hunting vest. Those are much more beautiful when they're blooming than they are in the fall.
Yeah, they tend to be a little annoying. My trick is always get a pocket knife and just scrape your pants off before you go in the house.
Yeah, right on. All right, number nine, I teased a moment ago. It's got my absolute favorite name of a pollinator plant, the Rattlesnake Master. It's like Game of Thrones we've reverted to. Sierra, you're going to tell us about Rattlesnake Master as well.
Yep, so number nine, Rattlesnake Master. Scientific name is Oryngium yuccifolium. And that scientific name is because it really does look like a yucca plant. So if you guys can imagine like an aloe plant that have kind of the spiky edges along the leaves, Rattlesnake Master has the same thing. So it kind of looks dangerous when you look at it. But I always thought that's how it got its name, Rattlesnake Master. But I was just reading actually last week and found out that Rattlesnake Master got its name from the fact that it can treat rattlesnake bites, or at least that's what, you know, and a long time ago, that's what people used it for. I actually have no idea how effective it is, but in the book I read, they said that's what it was used for. But it is a very cool-looking plant. I mean, obviously, it looks like a desert plant because it looks like, you know, a yucca or aloe plant. And amongst all of this greenery in the southeast, you're kind of like, what is that thing? It doesn't fit in at all. But it has these cool little, basically ball-shaped flowers on top that are little bitty white flowers that are kind of like a small spiky head. But listen, if you ever want to set up a photography kind of place and try and find the best pictures of pollinators, you set up on a Rattlesnake Master plant because they are a huge pollinator attractant. And as we discussed earlier, attracting pollinators is a good chick food resource as well.
And really, their geography is many, many places east of the Mississippi. So they are native to Minnesota, Wisconsin, Michigan. I actually have them in my backyard, Rattlesnake Master in my backyard. And it's a relatively new plant for us in our backyard pollinator plot that I was pretty excited to see growing this spring. And I went and visited it. Like, I walk around in the morning and see how things are doing. In the afternoon, I went, and this is probably early May. And by the afternoon, rabbits had munched on my Rattlesnake Master, which was infuriating. but it's kind of funny too, because you, like you mentioned, it visually it looks like a cactus, you know, and you wouldn't think like a yucca plant, or you know, and they have these spines to it, and you're like, well, the rabbits and the deer aren't going to bother that.
Surprise.
I was wrong.
Those spikes are, I think they're just look for looks, because when you like run your hand down the side of them, they really are like very soft. It's strange. Rattlesnake. I would say Rattlesnake Master is probably one of my favorite plants, and it's actually in my pollinator kit, and I am so excited to plant it. So obviously just moving in to my new husband's place, we're going to create everything native in the house. I don't know if he knows this yet, but we're pulling out all of the non-native stuff in the yard, and I'm so excited to plant the native rattlesnake master that's coming in my kit.
It's a very fun plant. All right, let's go to number 8 on the big board. Heather, it's your turn to jump in. Tell us about what wildflower hit at number 8.
Number 8 is purple coneflower, Echinacea purpurea. It is obviously purple, and the coneflowers are just awesome pollinator plants to have out there. The purple coneflower itself is common and a recognizable flower with dark pink to purple petals and a spiky center cone. Echinacea comes from the Greek word echinos, meaning hedgehog, because of the spiny center flower cone. So the centers of those cones just look kind of spiny. They're usually really nice open blooms that lots of insects can go to. So you usually see a variety of insects and bees and moths and butterflies go into the cone flowers. Sierra has some specific species in the southeast that she's noticed. They have a lot more pale purple cone flower in that part of the world. And she said they also have wavy leaf purple cone flowers, which have the leaf structure is a little bit different than the regular other cone flowers. The other thing about cone flowers too is, even in the Midwest, you know, more in the western part in like Nebraska, we have upright cone flower, which they're a smaller cone flower with a little bit different petal and open cone flower that those pollinators can go to. So we have upright cone flower, which can be yellow, and then we also have a variety called Mexican hat, which can be more of a burgundy and a yellow. So there's tons of different cone flowers, and then they have a little bit different plant structures too, those bigger cone flowers versus the smaller ones.
Yeah, and you know, so we talked about kind of the criteria for our top 10, and I think coneflower hits on them all. You know, it starts to create some structure. It's maybe not as high as what we're going to talk about next on our list in terms of structure and protection from avian predation. But it does create some structure. It's a food resource. Insects love them. But for me, coneflower gets all 5 stars when it comes to the wild card of beauty. I think purple coneflower, well, all coneflowers, but purple coneflower in particular is just one of the most beautiful wildflowers out there. It's just such a gorgeous, gorgeous flower when you're out looking at the prairie. All right.
And there's just so many different colors of the coneflowers too, which is really cool.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Like the purple is kind of, it jumps out at you, but when you think about the variety, there is a lot of varieties to different colors of coneflower. It's a sort of a fruity pebbles of the prairie, and that's often beautiful to think about. All right, let's go to number 7. I teased it with the comment about structure. Tell us what wildflower hits the board at number 7, Heather.
Well, number 7 is basically the goldenrods, the Solidago families of goldenrods, and there's species available in most regions of goldenrod. More in the western states, the north states that's in our pollinator kits are going to be Missouri goldenrod, and then gray and field goldenrod are going to be in the central north kit. Missouri giant, Canada goldenrod can be all kind of hard to tell apart. They can be very similar, but they're a great pollinator attractant. They have beautiful flowy fall blooms, providing that later season nectar resource that's really important to our pollinators later in the season. They are often confused with ragweed as the cause of terrible, horrible allergies. And it's a huge misconception. It's just they bloom at the same time as ragweed is blooming. So they've got those beautiful showy yellow flowers, and ragweed is much more inconspicuous. The other thing that's kind of cool about Canada goldenrod and giant or large goldenrod is the state flower of Nebraska. Go Big Red. And had to get that one in there today.
But they're yellow.
I know, but it's our state flower.
I know. Oh, I love it. There is everybody from Nebraska has so much pride being able to yell out "Go Big Red," and you did not disappoint, Heather. All right, the next one out of our entire top 10. So this one comes in sixth, but both of you wanted to talk about this one. You're like, I want it. No, I want it. So, all right, whoever wants to jump in first to tell us about number six, go for it.
I'll jump in. So number six is butterfly milkweed. Latin is Asclepias tuberosa. And gosh, this is just a beautiful flower. It has these bright orange to red blooms, and it kind of varies depending on where you're at. And to be honest with you, I'm not sure what causes the color differentiation, but I've noticed in some areas they are like neon, mm-hmm. and in other areas they're more of like a almost like a deeper reddish color, orangish red. But like other milkweeds, this does serve as a host for monarch caterpillars, which is obviously very important with their incredibly low numbers lately. And it's very important for the monarch life cycle. But I'll let Heather talk a little bit more about some other milkweeds if she wants.
And we kind of noticed too with butterfly milkweed. Butterfly milkweed is native more in those Midwest tall grass prairie areas. In like where I'm out in the southern part of Nebraska, we don't see butterfly milkweed as much, especially in fields and maybe in a CRP planting. But we definitely will see those in those backyard gardens, and those urban settings is where we'll definitely see butterfly milkweed too. We have a lot more showy milkweed in the western part of Nebraska. And then we have common milkweed, very common in Nebraska. But they're, like I said, they're very important. They're the only plants that, you know, monarch butterflies will lay their eggs on. And so it's a very much needed species. And there's so many different species across the United States of milkweeds, too. So milkweed is a very, very important plant for pollinator plantings.
Yeah, you guys both mentioned a variety of different species of milkweed. There are a bunch. That's, you know, as a kid, I kind of just identified with common milkweed. And as I've got this job and more connected to these plants, is like, wow, there's just a ton of different kinds of milkweed. And I think about swamp milkweed, which is kind of a negative, like swamps are ugly, but you see swamp milkweed and it's just gorgeous. It needs a little bit more moist soil, a la the swamp, but they're just beautiful pink flowers. And then, like you said, butterfly milkweed with their neon orange to almost red. I lump them into the purple coneflower category. You have a hard time. I have a hard time finding things that are more beautiful than butterfly milkweed and purple coneflower. And it is that one of the plants that's been in this kit, the pollinator kit, a number of different times. And that's, I think, partly because it does grow really well in the urban environments. Like in my backyard, it's not a plant that I have to nurture. I mean, it it's so beautiful. That's just great. You know, like there's some like prairie smoke. I've tried to plant prairie smoke like 13 times and I've never been able to get it going. But butterfly milkweed, like we plant that 13 times and it just keeps spreading. I mean, it's a gorgeous, gorgeous, gorgeous pollinator a plant. So, and that is in a variety of these mixes. So that's a really, really fun one. Okay, on to the second half of our top 10. We're on to the top 5. Heather, tell us what wildflower hit number 5 on our top 10 list.
Number 5, halfway through, is sunflowers, the helianthus. And again, it's another group of sunflowers. that can vary from region to region based on soil types and precipitation amount region to region. Sunflowers are awesome. There's so many varieties. There's so much different plant structure with different sunflowers. I love them. Maximilian sunflower in the southwest and the western part of Nebraska, we use it quite a bit. And we love it because it's a nice, big, tall one with little bitty blooms that go all the way up the stem. But if you get to the eastern part of Nebraska, they don't like to use it as much in the seeding mixes because it can border on being invasive. So there's a lot of these plants that we plant that you want to be careful and cautious on how much you put in your seeding mixes so you don't get too much seed in there that they have that tendency to become invasive. But bobwhites consume the seeds of a lot of the sunflowers. The seeds have high oil content, making them a valuable energy source. The other things that we're starting to see is sunflowers can make a really good, like a dense forward planting area. They can be kind of similar to a shrub thicket in their structure. And so the sunflower families, we like to use those because, again, we get some great different plant structure in those. Common sunflower or annual sunflower is a absolute structure powerhouse. It's an indicator of bare ground and early successional habitat, and it makes great bare areas underneath those big plants for those little broods to get around a lot better. Like I said, sometimes they can become invasive. Sometimes our goldenrods can become invasive, and a lot of that's based on the precipitation in those regions. So just you have to use some of these with some sense and not using too much seed so they become invasive.
So I love sunflowers as well because I think about a couple things you mentioned there, the connection with quail. Like anytime I'm hunting in Nebraska or Kansas and you're walking a field and you know, it's the first thing on our list of indicators or evaluation criteria is structure. And you're walking a field of grass and you're like, in the distance, I see sunflower stems. And I gravitate to walk in that direction with my bird dog because when you start to see sunflowers, it starts to feel quaily. And that, you know, I don't know if that's a real word or not. But
of course it is.
It connects, right? When you see sunflower stems, it feels quaily. And I think that's there's multiple reasons there. It is because of the structure. Heather, you mentioned also the bare ground because, and you touched on it, those chicks need the bare ground to find insects, to pick seeds. Like if it's just a mass of grass that's just matted together, they can't move through it. And that continues, I mean, let's face it, adult bobwhite quail are not giant, right? So their ability to move around requires bare cover. When you think about sunflowers, you have structure protecting them from avian predators above. It helps produce bare ground for them to move underneath. And there's food. It's like, food, shelter, all together. Sunflowers are a really, really terrific habitat component. It's like it's number five. It's almost like, wow, how is that not number one?
Yeah, I like to tell my landowners whenever I'm working with them about when I'm telling them about structure and what quail specifically need. That bare ground component is critical, and I like to tell them like just to get an image in their mind is. Think back to that movie, Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, which apparently I'm getting old now, so a lot of young people look at me like I'm crazy, but you think about those kids trying to, like, climb through the backyard to get back to the back porch. Think of that as a bobwhite quail chick. I mean, they're the size of golf balls, mm-hmm. And if you have too thick of grass or not enough bare ground, they can't move through it quickly, so predators, they make much easier targets that way, as well as just the ability to get to food sources makes it a lot harder.
So, at number five, everybody can envision a sunflower or a member of the sunflower family. As we go to number four, Sierra, it's a little bit more difficult for people to envision number four. Tell us what number four is.
Yeah, so number four came in as round-headed bush clover, or Lespediza capitata. And Lespediza as a whole, they're a great group of food source for quail as well. The seeds are a favorite for the round-headed bush clover. The seeds are a favorite of bod whites. And these seeds hold on well into winter, providing that food source for a longer period of time. We have lots of different Lespedizas out there, especially in my range. The one I saw the most in Arkansas is probably slender Lespediza. But again, there's a bajillion different species of them. One thing I did want to point out that a lot of listeners may not understand, they hear Lespediza and they may think of Sericea Lespediza, which in the past, before my time, it was planted in mass groves for quail and turkey food, and they thought that it would be a great resource for them. Well, it come to find out it's non-native, and it is highly, highly invasive. This is my number, like the Sericea Lespediza, let's be specific here, is like my number one hated plant. It's not native, and it takes over areas in the southeast, especially where I was at in Arkansas. And it's really hard to kill out because it's growing seasons at the same time as the natives. But the seeds from Sericea Lespediza, quail cannot digest. Like the seed coating on them is not enough or is too hard for the quail to digest. So they're just wasting energy eating those seeds. So I just really want to hammer home that native Lespedizas are phenomenal, and I encourage them. If one way to tell them apart, they do look very similar. I mean, if you're looking at two stems side by side, they're really hard to tell apart. One, you can look for just a mat of it, most likely Sericea. If it's just single stems here and there, kind of in together in an area, most likely native. Like, I can't tell you every species of Lespediza when I look up to it, but I can most likely tell you if it's native or not, just based off how it's growing. Wow. If you look at the veins in the leaves, if you hold it up to the sunlight, Sericea Lespediza have, like, very straight lines that almost look like a fishbone skeleton kind of thing, whereas the native Lespedizas are almost like little bitty blocks kind of built up together. So if you're out in the field and you're just wondering if it's a native Lespediza or not, pick off that leaf and hold it up to the sunlight and see.
Well, or contact your Pheasants Forever, Quail Forever Farm Bill biologist, right?
I mean, yeah,
this is part of what the expertise that our team brings is to help make sure that when you're putting together mixes and planting for your conservation plans, that you're putting the right stuff in that is going to benefit the birds and the bees. And round-headed bush clover, Lespediza capitata, is the right one.
Correct. All right.
Let's go.
There's a couple of other things. When we were talking to some of our biologists up here, the plant seems to persist longer in the plantings. So it's a plant that's got a really good long life, a good longevity. Mm. And one of the other things I thought was really cool is livestock actually find it fairly palatable, I think, when it's young. So, there you go.
Nice.
So it got some additional benefits for it. All right, we will stick with Sierra and go to number three.
So number three came out as Illinois Bundleflower, Desmanthus illinoisensis. I think I said that right. This plant is probably more important for brood cover than for food, but it is a good indication for plant managers of good cover. So the structure itself is almost like a little bush, but I don't know if anyone is familiar with sensitive briar, the little plant that has like the purple firework bloom on it and you touch it and the leaves fold up. It's a favorite of mine to show landowners because they think it's incredible. But the Illinois Bundleflower has the same leaf structure, so it's very feathery looking, but when you touch it, it doesn't fold up and it doesn't have any briars on it. But like I said, it almost creates like a little bush that kind of has, you know, good structure for that quail to get around underneath and have that bare ground. So this plant has a lot of seeds on it, but they're probably harder to get to, at least for quail that are low to the ground. They produce these little seed ball. They're the little, almost like green bean pods that are folded up together into a little ball. And the blue on this is very inconspicuous. It's a little white, almost like a little firework, a little puffball, but they're very small. And to be honest with you, I've only seen them in bloom a couple of times. I just never can quite catch them. So I'm assuming their bloom period is very short, but still an absolutely incredible flower, and important for that good structure and food resource.
It's interesting you talk about them, this plant being kind of shrubby or bush-like, and, you know, on a variety of podcasts, we talk with our quail biologists, and they're like, quail are shrub obligates, right? And that, I'm assuming, is connection to why this Illinois bundleflower is so beneficial, because quail in particular really gravitate to them, as you mentioned, brood cover.
Very much so.
All right, we're going back to Heather for number two. And again, this one that just brings the pop of color. Go ahead, Heather. What's number two?
Number two is wild bergamot. It is a beautiful light purple flower with a lovely fragrance. And I think kind of what I like about bergamot too is the flowers are like stacked up on top of each other on the stem. So as you go closer to the ground, the flower itself is bigger. And then it just kind of, they kind of just stack up like a little pyramid, and they have smaller blooms as you get closer to the top of the stem. It's mint. It's in the mint family. And most of our mint flowers have a square stem. So the next time that you're out and you see some of these bergamots, or they call them bee balm. And this was one thing that I found today that I thought was really cool. It just explains bergamot and bee balm really well. Is they have long blooming fragrant flowers, and they're inviting to bees. That's why they call them bee balm, is because they're so inviting to the bees. And you will see tons of bees, even little tiny bees and bigger bees around any of these bergamot or the bee balm family.
Yeah, I can personally testify to bee balm or bergamot is a pollinator, one of their favorites. You know, in our little backyard pollinator patch, when bergamot is blooming, they probably suck in 80% of the honeybees, the monarchs, at least the monarchs go to them. The hummingbird moths love them. Hummingbirds go to them. I mean, it is unbelievable how attractant bergamot is to insects, or bergamot are to insects. The other thing for the urban person that wants to plant pollinators, like I mentioned about butterfly milkweed a moment ago, bergamot too is super easy, at least in the Twin Cities metro, to grow. It doesn't take a green thumb. You know, you plant bergamot and it will grow and it will take off. It is an app and it's gorgeous. It's one of those like, oh, it's expanding. Great. You know, because some things you say, oh, it's expanding. And you don't feel that way about this one. This one is just like, take over the whole backyard. It's just glorious.
Yeah, it's very eye-catching. This was definitely one that I made the majority of my wedding bouquet out of, just because it is such a beautiful pop of color.
Yeah. Yeah. It doesn't really surprise me that that one hit the list at number two. That one does really attract the pollinators, and it does create kind of that bushy component to it that is really important to pheasants and for quail. And that's probably another component, is it's in both, you know. It's here in Minnesota, it's in Tennessee, it's in Arkansas. You know, our upland birds use wild bergamot. And if you're going to be planting a pollinator mix, that's one to definitely have. All right. The number one plant on our wildflower top 10. Let me ask you both this before you unveil it. Heather, Sierra, did you know that this was going to be number one when we did the survey? Heather's shaking her head no. And Sierra, no? or sorta.
I didn't think it would be a sorta, I guess. It's very important, but with showiness as a part, I wouldn't have picked it as number one in my personal opinion, just with that structure, or for all the botanists that we surveyed. I didn't know that it was going to be number one.
But it does have a upland game bird in its name, so that probably helped it a little bit. All right, Heather, take it away.
Okay, so the number
we got to do
drum roll, number one
on the wildflower list is
partridge pea, sometimes called showy partridge pea, some kind called just partridge pea. And I am not going to attempt to say the scientific name because I have no clue. Sierra, do you have any attempt at all?
Listen, I've been calling it Chamacrista fasciculata for years. Now, whether that's right or not, don't quote me.
I had no idea how to pronounce it. I think one of the things that I notice with partridge pea is if I know that I'm designing it for a CRP mix, that's one of the first plants that you're going to see bloom. When you're kind of talking to landowners is when you're planting pollinator mixes and you're planting all these forbs, they're going to be this big, weedy looking mass of weeds, nothing but weeds. But they're not weeds. They're these broadleaf plants, these forbs. Lots of them are natives. And partridge pea is one of those that you can maybe see that comes quicker than any of the other ones. It'll kind of come in the same time like blanket flower and black-eyed Susan come in. And I know that we've put it in there, and that's a good indicator of me that, hey, I think we're going to get some of these things to come up in this drilled mix.
So when you say it's going to be one of the first you see, what you're referencing is not that it blooms early in the year. What you mean is that it establishes, so you start to see it early. That's an important distinction because with pollinating flowers, you have an early bloomer, middle bloomer, and a late bloomer. And you want to have bloom periods where you, in your pollinator patch, you have flowers that are blooming in all three periods to produce nectar for insects. But what you're referencing is that sometimes it takes a couple of years, even a few years, before your pollinators get the root system established enough for them to be able to bloom. And that's what you're talking about is partridge pea is one of the early establishing flowers that can bloom. Go ahead, Sierra.
Yeah, I just wanted to point out, I heard this a few years ago and I thought it was very beneficial for landowners and easy to remember. When you are trying to establish a pollinator plot with a planting, like Bob said, it's going to take a little bit. You got to be patient. Patience is number one key. Besides site prep. Site prep is actually number one. But it's called sleep, creep, leap. So that first year, most of the flowers that you planted are sleeping. I mean, they're working on their root systems. You don't know what's going on. You can't see what's going on. But they're establishing, like Bob said. That second year, you're going to start seeing some creeping up flowers. So most of the time what I see, like she said, are some very, most of the time in Arkansas, it was yellow flowers was like our first initial. And the majority of those were partridge pea. And then that third year is really when you start seeing a lot of those more perennial plants being able to bloom. They've established their root systems and they are able to just thrive. And you're starting to see more of your purples, your yellows, your blues, things like that. So sleep, creep, leap. Remember that.
Sleep, creep, leap.
Yes. Whoops.
Very nice.
Go
ahead, Heather.
It's an annual plant in the bean family. And we use it for, wildflower plantings for quail, turkey, other game birds. The seeds are eaten by quail as well as other birds. It's a high larval host plant for cloudless giant sulfur, little yellow, sleepy orange. So I'm assuming that most of these are butterflies and or moths of some sort, great pollinator species that we need. It's more of a food source in the south than it is in the Midwest, but it's also another good indicator of brood rearing habitat as well, have those kind of bare open areas underneath it. I did find a thing today too that says sometimes it can be touch sensitive like bundle flower. So when you touch the leaves, those leaves may roll back up too. I found that one. This one also is full of protein. It's supposed to have like 40% crude protein. The seed is often found late in the winter months for them, so that seed stays on the plant longer into the fall and the winter. And like I said, it's usually one of those first bloomers that you'll see in a newly planted seeding. And the deer and the cattle will eat the foliage.
Hmm. Very cool. And you mentioned it's part of the bean family. It's a legume, which explains a little bit about having that seed or the bean that the birds are going to eat it. And really, it's somewhat understated yellow flower. It's pretty, but I had no idea that it was going to be kind of the top pick. But as you start to read off all of its attributes, it's like, okay, checks that box, checks that box, checks that box. You know, it brings a lot of positivity to the pheasant and quail world. So there you have it, folks. Number one on the top 10 wildflower list as voted on by a sampling of Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever biologists is the partridge pea. So if you are putting together a pollinator mix for your back 40 or your backyard, make sure you got partridge pea in that mix. Before I remind listeners of the membership offer, any closing thoughts that Sierra or Heather you'd like to offer our audience?
I just want to say, get out there and see what you got. Not always does it require a planting of killing what's out there with herbicides or something, or disking and then planting something new. Sometimes you already have what you need in terms of native plants. It just might need a little help. Mm. You might have some other non-native grass or something that's just suppressing it, and you might just need to help it out and give it a little love. So go out there with some plant ID guides, or take a biologist. We love to nerd out over this stuff. Take us out there with you. We love to get out at the office and go look at some plants.
Heather, you're smiling in agreement. You love going out in the field, don't you?
I do. We got to spend a couple of days last week and talking about just getting, you know, last week was wildflower week, evidently, in Nebraska. And just being able to go out and see those plants, and see what's blooming this week that wasn't blooming last week, and take a friend and teach them along the way. And you'll always teach each other something else, too. The other thing I did a long time ago is a lot of these plants are what are considered a xeriscape plant. So once you get them established, they're low water, low maintenance, and most of them need a lot of sun. So most of our pollinators that we're putting in these pollinator mixes, you know, they need a good 6 to 8 hours of sun during the day. So when you're doing your pollinator plantings, you know, try to plant them in a place that you don't mow, that has a lot of sun, and they'll probably do really well. Once you leave them alone, then you're going to have hopefully more and more the year in years after. That's usually when we see milkweed. You usually see a nice big clump of it, because that's how they, you know, distribute the seed, is through the wind. And you'll see that nice little colony of milkweed, or goldenrod's the same way too. You just kind of see a nice little colony of them somewhere.
Good for the bees, good for the butterflies, good for the birds, and good for all of us too. They bring a lot of joy, whether it's through the habitat they create or just the sheer beauty that they provide all of us in their bloom period. Folks, if you would like to connect with a Pheasants Forever or Quail Forever biologist, we've got hundreds of biologists all over the country. Go to pheasantsforever.org or quailforever.org. Under the conservation tab, you can click on Find a Biologist, enter in your zip code, and it'll populate the nearest biologist to you. And our biologists love to talk to you about your habitat projects, particularly your pollinator projects. From the back 40 to your backyard, with projects big or small, creating native habitat benefits pollinators, it benefits birds, and it benefits a whole bunch of different wildlife species. And we all can be habitat creators. Become a habitat creator this pollinator week by checking out pheasantsforever.org/pollinatorweek, or quailforever.org/pollinatorweek for your contribution of $35 or $75, you'll get a membership to Pheasants Forever, Quail Forever, a native plant kit with 6 plants, a pollinator habitat sign, an exclusive Habitat Creators sticker, and an e-planting guide. For Sierra, we're just going to call you Sierra now. We just go by one name.
Perfect. It's not very common anyway. So.
For Sierra and for Heather, I'm Bob St. Pierre, thanking you for listening. Become a pollinator member through Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever. And remember to always follow the dog, especially through pollinator habitat. It's where the quail live. It's where the pheasants live. Something good will rise, folks. Thanks for listening.